This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, July 26, 2007. Filling in for Otto Bogato, I'm Mitch Jezrich at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. South Korean hostages plea for the release after being kidnapped in Afghanistan a week ago. A defense contractor is accused of trafficking humans to build the U.S. embassy in Iraq. And the Senate approves a $3 billion border crackdown bill. All this and more after these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Four members of the Senate Judiciary Committee have announced they are asking the Solicitor General to appoint a special counsel to investigate potential perjury by Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. The senators want the special prosecutor to investigate if Gonzalez lied while testifying under oath about the extent of domestic surveillance and dissent within the Justice Department regarding those programs. Senator Chuck Schumer speaking at today's press conference.
Earlier this week, Attorney General Gonzalez testified before the Judiciary Committee, and his inability to answer simple and straightforward questions was just stunning. The Attorney General took an oath to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Instead, he tells the half-truth, the partial truth, and everything but the truth.
Senator Dianne Feinstein says the committee has called for a special counsel from outside of the Justice Department, largely for three reasons.
One, to look at whether, in fact, the department has been politicized. Two, to evaluate his misleading and often untrue statements to the Congress. And to also look at the administration's decision to block any United States attorney from pursuing charges of contempt of Congress against officials who have refused to comply with congressional subpoenas. I have never seen an attorney general so contemptuous of Congress and his role as the chief law enforcement officer of the United States.
In related news, Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Patrick Leahy issued subpoenas today for two key White House officials, presidential adviser Karl Rove and White House Political Affairs Deputy Director J. Scott Jennings have been ordered to testify before Congress as part of the ongoing investigation into the mass firing of U.S. attorneys. The two White House officials have been cited to hand over documents and give testimony by the morning of August 2nd. In other news, the Egyptian and Jordanian foreign ministers met with senior Israeli politicians in Jerusalem yesterday in a bid to revive a peace initiative approved by 22 Arab states. The meeting marked the first official visit ever made to Israel by an Arab League delegation. Ghassan Banour reports from Bethlehem.
The plan called for full recognition of the State of Israel and normalization of relations in exchange for Israel's withdrawal to its pre-1967 borders, the establishment of a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital, and an agreed just solution for the Palestinian refugees of 1948. Israel and the U.S. have sued to involve more nations in the talks, and yesterday Olmert asked the Egyptian and Jordanian foreign ministers to encourage more Arab states to join their next meeting on the initiative. The other nations have so far refused to participate in the talks, and the head of the Arab League indicated that the two ministers are not acting on behalf of the organization. Israeli media has reported a separate Israeli proposal for general principles of agreement that would potentially form the basis for peace negotiations. The Israeli proposal calls for the establishment of a Palestinian state on 90% of the land currently comprising of the West Bank and Gaza, with borders likely following the route of the illegal separation wall. For FSRN, I am Ghassan Banoura.
The security situation in the southern Iraqi city of Basra has taken a turn for the worse. Hiba Dawood files this report.
Basra hospital doctors are 3 days into a strike called in response to the deteriorating security situation for hospital staff. Two doctors were killed last week, another was kidnapped, and another doctor's house was raided and ransacked by an armed group. The striking doctors want the Iraqi government to provide more security to the healthcare workers, particularly since medical professionals are under tremendous pressure in the war-torn country. Today, 7 Katyusha missiles fell on a residential district in Basra, causing damage to buildings and cars. In another incident, three employees from the Iraqi Southern Oil Company were arrested for robbing an armored truck that was delivering salaries to the company's workers. The recent surge in violence is unusual for Basra, which has had a relatively stable security situation for the last 4 years. Basra is important to Iraq's economy as it lies in an oil-rich region and is the location of the country's only seaport. I'm Hiba Dawood for FSRN.
A report released today by the Environmental Integrity Project predicts that CO2 pollution from old and inefficient electricity generating plants could lead to a 34% rise in carbon dioxide emissions by the year 2030. The nonprofit environmental group has just published a list ranking the 50 dirtiest power plants in the country. 5 of those facilities are in Texas, which tops the list of states with heavy concentrations of dirty power plants. Other states with problem facilities include Pennsylvania, Indiana, Alabama, and Georgia. The Environmental Integrity Project estimates that U.S. power plants release roughly 2.5 billion tons of carbon dioxide every year. Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
In Iraq today, at least 25 people were killed and 60 injured in a car bomb attack in Baghdad's Qurrata district. The attack occurred just south of a U.S. embassy and several Iraqi government buildings. It was the deadliest of a number of attacks that killed at least 40 people across the country today. Allegations of human trafficking of workers to build the $600 million U.S. embassy in Iraq was highlighted today in Congress. Two whistleblowers accused a multifaceted defense contractor of kidnapping workers from developing countries and forcing them to Baghdad to work. Free Speech Radio News' Leanne Caldwell has more on the story.
John Owens is a contracted employee who works on U.S. embassies around the world. He describes the working conditions at the construction site of the U.S. embassy in Iraq as deplorable.
Foreign workers were packed into trailers very tight. There was insufficient equipment and basic needs like shoes and gloves. The contract for these workers said they had to work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, with some time off on Friday for prayers. A few people from India told me they were making $240 a month. A guy from Sierra Leone told me he got paid $300 a month. Many of the workers were verbally and physically abused, intimidated, and had their salaries docked for as much as 3 days' pay, for reasons such as being 5 minutes late, sitting down on the job, and other stuff.
Owen says the contractor, First Kuwaiti, relies on cheap labor. Very few Americans and Iraqis do the work. Most came from India, Pakistan, Sierra Leone, and Asia. And as Rory Mayberry, another contractor, says, it's often against their will. Mayberry also went to Baghdad to work on the embassy. He describes the plane flight there, where he was told to make sure 51 Filipinos boarded the plane.
When we got to the Kuwait airport, I noticed that all their tickets said that we were going to Dubai. I asked why. A First Kuwaiti manager told me that the Filipino passports do not allow Filipinos to fly to Iraq. They must be marked going to Dubai. The First Kuwaiti manager added that I should not tell any of the Filipinos that they were being taken to Baghdad. As I found out later, these men thought that they had signed up for jobs to work in Dubai hotels. They had no idea that they were being sent to do construction at the work at the embassy. Well, Mr. Chairman, when the airplane took off and the captain announced that we were headed to Baghdad, all you know what broke out on the airplane. The men started shouting. It wasn't until the security guy working for First Kuwaiti waved an MP5 in the air that the men settled down. They realized that they had no other choice but to go to Baghdad. Let me spell it out clearly. I believe these men were kidnapped by First Kuwaiti to work on the U.S. embassy.
First Kuwaiti holds 200 contracts from the U.S. military or State Department, totaling $500 million. The House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform held this hearing as part of a series to highlight fraud and abuse with contractors in Iraq. Republican committee leader Tom Davis of Virginia attempted to discount the testimony, questioning the credibility of John Owens.
If, in fact, you have a lawsuit coming against First Kuwaiti, which I think we can assume we have, because if it's a sealed order, obviously, that you do. Wouldn't you say that publicly smearing the defendant is also to your monetary advantage? Wouldn't it be?
I'm legally prevented from answering that question.
I think we get the picture.
Howard Krongard, Inspector General with the State Department, says First Kuwaiti has committed no wrongdoing.
That except for recruitment fees, illegal in some workers' country of origin, there was no evidence of trafficking in person violations.
The company has come under fire for more than the treatment of their employees, also for the inadequacy of their work. They were charged with misconfiguring electrical wires, which has caused a meltdown at the embassy complex. That complex, which was supposed to open in May, remains closed and unused because they have not yet fixed the problem. Representative John Tierney of Massachusetts asked Carl Deming, a contractor for Kellogg Brown & Root, about the quality of work at the U.S. Embassy.
Ought there be some concern about the wiring in other parts of the embassy?
I'd like to defer that opinion, Mr. Congressman.
I know you would, sir, but I'm asking for your opinion.
My opinion, there may be concern here.
The U.S. Embassy is set to open on time in September. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
A South Korean woman has pleaded for her release and the release of 21 other South Koreans who were abducted by Taliban fighters in Afghanistan last week. Yo Sung-ju told an Afghan reporter in a telephone interview that all of the hostages are sick. This comes as the dead body of the abducted group's leader, Protestant pastor Bai Hong-ki, was found yesterday with multiple gunshots. Seoul has sent an envoy to Afghanistan to negotiate the remaining hostages' release. Jason Struthers has more on the story.
South Koreans have been glued to their televisions ever since the Taliban seized 23 aid workers near the city of Kandahar last week. The missionaries were said to be in Afghanistan to provide medical relief to the war-torn region. The BBC carried an interview with one of the hostages over a phone line while she was being guarded by one of her Taliban captors. Envoys from Seoul left for Kabul today. They will try to negotiate for the release of the remaining 22 hostages. The kidnappers have reportedly submitted a list of imprisoned Taliban insurgents that they want traded for an equal number of Koreans. They've also stated they want South Korean troops out of Afghanistan. Currently, there are about 200 non-combat Korean soldiers on the ground. The Ministry of Defense here in Seoul says that those forces had already been scheduled to leave Afghanistan by the end of this year. This is not the first time that Korean evangelicals have gotten into trouble there. Last year, nearly 1,000 Christians were asked to leave by the Kabul government after they planned a so-called peace march. Locals accused the group of trying to convert Muslims and threatened them with violence. Dr. Jong Wong-shik is a professor at the Methodist Theological Seminary in Seoul. He says that Korean missionaries have earned a militant reputation in non-Christian countries. Jung believes now is a turning point for these groups.
Their position or their attitude toward other religion has been so a little bit push and aggressive. I think they have to change their position. They have to be more generous toward other religion. They should learn a lot about other religions' faith and their religious and cultural surroundings.
For Free Speech Radio News in Seoul, South Korea, I'm Jason Struther.
The U.S. Senate today approved a measure to spend an additional $3 billion to crack down on the southern U.S.-Mexican border. The measure, which is part of the massive Homeland Security spending bill, received wide support from both parties with a 98-1 vote. The measure would deploy an additional 23,000 Border Patrol agents, purchase 4 unmanned aerial vehicles, build 700 miles of the border fence, and purchase 45,000 beds that would go towards new detention facilities to hold people who are caught while entering the country without proper documentation. Kat Rodriguez with the immigrant rights groups Coalición de Derechos Humanos in Tucson, Arizona, says that lawmakers from non-border communities don't realize what these measures do for those living near the border.
The legislators, the majority of them who, vast majority of them who are passing these bills, to them it's a line in a bill. And so to us, though, it's the actual walls in our communities. It's the checkpoints, it's the drag roads, it's the stadium lights, it's the vehicle barriers, it's, racial profiling of, people being pulled over constantly. It's the increased intensity that is caused by, being in a militarized zone. And the truth is, since militarization began in the mid-1990s, and you're looking at billions and billions of dollars that have been spent on this, on the walls, drag roads, stadium lights, all of these pieces, not to mention Border Patrol agents, and not to mention, in addition to building all of these things, you have to upkeep and maintain it. The actual number of people coming into the country hasn't really changed much.
And that was Kat Rodriguez from the immigrant rights groups Derechos Humanos in Tucson, Arizona. The $3 billion border crackdown measure must still be reconciled with the House of Representatives. Meanwhile, the House this week continues to consider a multi-billion-dollar farm bill. The measure has run into trouble as Democrats have inserted into it an oil and gas corporate tax that has caused some Republicans to withdraw their support. Meanwhile, the bill continues to offer large federal subsidies for U.S. farmers, and Matt Laszlo reports that some say the bill would continue to keep poor U.S. farmers poor, as well as cripple farmers across the globe.
Well, the American farm programs in the farm bill are really a broken promise to America's farmers, to rural development, to poor people in this country.
Laura Russo is a spokesperson for Oxfam America. She says because the farm bill distributes money according to acreage and number of bushels, it ends up helping already rich farmers.
Well, the reality is that American farmers, especially small, struggling, minority, socially disadvantaged farmers, are not benefiting at all from this farm bill. In fact, it's the large-scale, industrial-sized farms that are the ones benefiting. Three-quarters of American farmers are not benefiting from these programs.
In addition, many international economists say heavy subsidies for U.S. farmers lower the global prices for crops such as wheat, soybeans, and sugar. Russo says that a study released by Oxfam America last month shows that by reducing U.S. subsidies on cotton alone, millions of West Africans would benefit.
It would have a direct effect on cotton-producing households in West Africa, and in fact, it could lead to over a million people being fed for a year, or 2 million kids going to school for a year.
But many lawmakers, like Democratic Iowa Congressman Leonard Boswell, disagree with calls to end or reduce subsidies.
Every man, woman, and child in this country has a vested interest in agriculture. We eat, and there's some reason that we have the least costly food in the world. The amount of disposable income, you look at it, you go look it up, it'll run 14-17% compared to modern Europe, high standard of living, it's 25 and more. Up to the undeveloped countries, it's 100%. That's because we all participate. And we're not just helping that farmer out there, we're helping ourselves to have this least expensive, most available, safest food in the world.
But cheap food comes at a cost. Scott Faber is a farm policy expert with Environmental Defense. He says farm subsidies have encouraged farmers to plow and fertilize bad growing lands. This has led to increased chemical runoff and has drastically changed ecosystems, creating difficult environmental challenges. Faber says a balance needs to be struck.
We've lost about 10% of our pasture land in the last two decades, which has created some significant new environmental challenges. So, you know, we need to come up with a safety net that helps farmers, that helps them weather the ups and downs of agriculture, but that doesn't send signals that encourage them to plow up marginal lands to grow more crops.
This year's bill has ballooned to over $300 billion. Faber says all that money will continue the cycle of farmers using the wrong land.
It's the economic signal that's sent by the subsidy that makes it economically feasible in the minds of many farmers to bring pasture and rangeland into production.
President Bush signed a similar farm bill in 2002, but he has threatened to veto this year's bill. He wants subsidies only to go to farmers who make less than $200,000. The current bill allows subsidies to farmers who make up to $1 million. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Southern California grocery workers averted a strike when they voted in favor of a new contract over the weekend. Critics say that while the agreement provides some improvements, it doesn't go far enough for the most vulnerable workers. Leilani Albano has more on the story.
Yes, I'm happy with the contract.
What I've seen so far sounds really good.
It did increase our wages, so that's the good part about it.
United Food and Commercial Workers with Los Angeles Local 1770 also expressed satisfaction with their new contract. After 6.5 months of stalled labor talks, a majority of the 65,000 Southern California supermarket employees at Albertsons, Ralph's, and Vaughn's stores voted in support of a new four-year agreement. The contract vote took place just days after the union warned that workers were prepared to strike if negotiations remained at an impasse. Rick Icaza, president of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, is touting the settlement as a win for workers.
I'm elated to be able to have it. If you walk in there, people just come up to me and they're, after they see the results, and they are just ecstatic.
The Southern California campaign, which was backed by the L.A. County Federation of Labor, was among several labor contracts currently being negotiated throughout the nation, including Northern California, Oregon, and the Pacific Northwest. The new contract addresses some of the pitfalls of the 2004 agreement. Under the deal, employees would receive their first raise in 5 years. The pact would also reduce the waiting period for new workers to be eligible for health insurance. In addition, the agreement would eliminate the two-tiered system, which offered lower wages and benefits to recently hired employees. Again, Ikaza.
I can honestly say now that the UFCW union jobs are comparable as almost as they were before. And so we have now a middle class job that members will benefit in the future from.
But while labor organizers are lauding the new contract, Muffy Sunday, who is a member of the Communication Workers of America, an organizer with the Freedom Socialist Party, says the agreement was ratified on the backs of grocery workers.
It is a victory for management that they didn't have to face another huge strike that cost them hundreds of millions of dollars.
Although grocery employees will now be eligible for health care in a shorter period of time, many new workers may still be unable to pay for insurance.
If you're a clerk that's making $8.30 an hour, and you're working 20 hours a week, and you expect to pay $28 a month for health care coverage, most people are going to opt not to do it.
And while the contract has eliminated the two-tiered system, wage increases for many store positions are minimal.
The top-paid workers are meat cutters, and their top wages is $19.68 an hour.
She says co-workers earning bottom pay will fare little better with a new wage scale.
What used to be called courtesy clerks and is now called clerks helpers are barely making minimum wage and will continue to barely make minimum wage.
Linda Averill, a member of the King County Labor Council in Washington State, is also critical of the new deal.
It's not a family wage job. It's not even a wage for a single person.
Sunday acknowledges the union's efforts to win improved wages and health care for workers.
I think the union probably negotiated really, really hard.
But she says in the end, the UFCW contract was a limited improvement. Instead, Averill says supermarket employees should have taken organizing to another level by enlisting labor support throughout the U.S. in their contract fights.
They need to go out nationally so that, you know, a grocery store back east can't help the grocery stores in Southern California. So there needs to be a national plan, and the AFL-CIO and the Change to Win unions need to get together and go out together.
Sunday agrees.
They would have had to try to close all the stores on the West Coast. They would have had to close the warehouses. If they'd done that, they would have really been able to vault themselves out of this awful contract they signed in 2004.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leilani Albano in Los Angeles.
At the three-way junction of India, China, and Burma, a bloody war has been ongoing for 60 years. The indigenous Naga population's demand for a separate homeland started in 1947 when India annexed the area. Since then, a bitter guerrilla war has taken over 200,000 lives. A 1997 ceasefire has been followed by a decade of uneasy peace. But as Vinod K. Joes reports, there are concerns of a resumption in fighting.
This war song reverberated in the Naga hills for over 50 years until 1997, when the National Socialist Council for Nagaland reached a ceasefire with the Indian government. After 10 years of failed talks over self-determination for the Naga, the threat of war is back. The 85-year-old Naga fighter Horangse remembers the fighting only too clearly.
You see, wives were raped before the eyes of the husband and the children. The daughters were raped by the Indian army before the eyes of the parents and the relatives. In some villages, the women folk were separated from the men folk, and all the men folk were killed. That is the highest degree of humiliation, because I've seen with my own eyes.
The ceasefire was meant to permit talks on self-determination for the Naga. Jason Masemo is a Naga leader.
The government of India did not take the peace talk seriously. For them, it's a ploy to weaken the movement and make the issue irrelevant, the issue of self-determination, the issue of nationality questions. That is precisely the reason why the Naga people are not happy and peace process does not move forward.
Professor Kumar Sanjay Singh is an expert on the Naga conflict. He thinks while the Nagas were observing the conditions of the ceasefire, India was strengthening its military position.
Military hardware has increased. Military cantonments have been opened up in all the strategic positions in the city and the entry and exit point. So it is almost appearing as if the government is trying to militarily encircle the area. Now that is a very wrong signal to give, because you cannot wage war while you talk peace.
R. Prasannan, writer for The Week magazine, has seen the talk sympathetic to government positions.
There is no military solution to this. Military can only soften the guerrilla warfare. I mean, if you look at the history of guerrilla warfare right over many centuries, nowhere has conventional army won against a guerrilla force. There has no military has ever won a decisive military victory over a guerrilla force. Military can only soften the guerrilla, break his back to fight, that is all.
This strategy of breaking the guerrilla's backs led to the deaths of an estimated 200,000 civilians. Now, an end to the ceasefire could mean a return to violence. Achumbe Mukio, a Naga leader, fears the Indian army will again commit human rights violations.
When we talk of human rights violation, it is enormous. It is uncountable. In the process of Indian army's operation, they have burned down all our villages. Our sisters, our mothers, women are raped in front of the family members, in front of the villages, in front of the Naga people. Our brothers, our elders, our fathers were tortured and even killed, shot to death in front of the families. The churches were used as concentration camps, the playgrounds. Then day and night, 24 hours, sometimes even a week, without food, without water. It's so unfortunate that the international community, even the world community, could not even see, could not address the issues that Nagas were facing. It was such a tremendous violation. It is uncountable.
Despite earlier pledges, the government of India has offered little in negotiations. It is not willing to compensate victims of human rights violations, redraw state boundaries to create a Naga homeland, or grant increased autonomy. Instead, it has strengthened its military presence. Nagas have lost patience with the negotiations, and despite the risk, renewed armed conflict seems likely.
Sing our song together, Nagalim, grandest on earth.
For FSRN from the Naga areas, I'm Vinod K. Jose.
Victory, let this forever be ours.
Free Speech Radio News is produced by Monica Lopez and Tana Geise. Headlines editor is Shannon Young. DC editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our tech team is Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. If you'd like to listen to this or any other FSRN broadcast, please visit our website at www.fsrn.org. Filling in for Otto Bogato, I'm Mitch Jezerich in New York.